Parade is a 1998 Broadway musical with a book by Alfred Uhry and music and lyrics by Jason Robert Brown. It tells the true story of Leo Frank, a young Jewish New Yorker living in Atlanta in 1913, when he was convicted for the rape and murder of a girl named Mary Fagan. By our best understanding, Frank was innocent, and his wrongful conviction was largely due to rampant sensationalism and anti-Semitism. The musical follows him and his wife Lucille, from the moment right before the crime happens all the way to his tragic murder at the hands of people enraged that his death sentence had been commuted to life in prison. So yeah, typical cheerful musical theater stuff. My guest today is Laura J. Brown, who describes herself as a theater lover and TV maker, but her bio really should just be Parade casting director, and you'll hear why. I hope you enjoy our conversation about Parade. Hello, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing good. I am excited to talk to you today. What are we talking about?
Parade.
Now, why did you want to talk about Parade? What's your personal background with it?
So it's my favorite musical of all time. I don't know how to do math. 15 years ago, 16 years ago, I saw Carolee Carmello in Mamma Mia, fell in love with her, decided to listen to everything that she had ever been in at that point. Listen to Parade. It just became my absolute favorite musical. It means the world to me. It's nostalgic for me. Obviously I don't have a personal connection. Like, I'm not Jewish and I've, never had something like that happen in my life, but it is just to me the most special musical.
Well, we're going to spend quite a while talking about different aspects of the musical, but I wonder, like, mm-hmm. Is there anything that jumps out to you just on the broadest level of why you think it's so special?
I just think it's a musical about hope and how sometimes hope cannot, we don't get there, Sometimes things happen and this country is effed up.
Yeah. Oh, man. So I'll say on my side, I was not familiar with Parade previously. Mm-hmm. And I was really not familiar with Parade. I didn't know what it was about. I had heard of it so many times and I'd always sort of heard it in conversations but it's one of those that I just somehow completely missed. And so there was a lot of interest in talking about it sort of in this season. And then so I sat down to listen to it the first time and I started reading the Wikipedia page. And the first thing I thought of was, so it's a Jason Robert Brown musical, and mm-hmm. I don't really like the last 5 years.
Me either.
And so okay. I was like, okay, well, let's do this. And then I start reading the Wikipedia page with the first line is like, this musical dramatizes the 1913 trial of Jewish factory worker Leo Frank, who was accused and convicted of raping and murdering a 13-year-old employee. And I was like, oh, God, okay, this is shifting everything I'm thinking about. This is a different time.
Yeah.
Whoa, I was not expecting that.
Yeah, it's when I tell people it's my favorite musical, they're like, isn't that depressing? And I'm like, and?
What do you think musicals are?
Right? Like, everyone's always like, oh, musicals are way too happy. I'm like, have you ever listened to Jason Robert Brown or Stephen Sondheim? Then you're lying.
Oh, man. And in reading about this, I also read that, this musical came from Hal Prince. Hal Prince wanted to do it and then was like, yes. Hey, Sondheim, do you want to write a musical about this? And he was like, no. And Hal Prince was like, who else is there? And someone was like, Jason Robert Brown's kind of good. He's like, all right, you do it.
Yeah, his literal daughter, Hal Prince's daughter, Daisy Prince, was friends with Jason Robert Brown and was like, hey, my friend Jason's pretty cool. And that's how it came about.
Can you imagine? I mean, I know that he had songs for New World previously, but this, mm-hmm. That's not a very long resume. And you met Hal Prince shows up at your door and is like, will you write a musical for me? What?
Right. Right. Being like, will you write a musical that I previously asked Stephen Sondheim to do? Like, imagine that, ego boost.
Yeah. And I love it. Sondheim is such a legend that even being the second choice after Sondheim is an ego boost. It's not right. Oh, someone else turned that down. It's like, Sondheim turned it down. You came right after him in the line. That's incredible.
Right. Absolutely. And I went to a panel of, with Hal Prince, Jason Robert Brown, and Alfred Uhry talking about it. Alfred Uhry wrote the book. And the reason why Hal wanted to do it is because he had some sort of personal connection to the actual case itself. And Alfred Ury, his great uncle owned the pencil factory that Leo Frank was the superintendent of.
That's so wild.
I know.
That's some deep level, like, just grappling with family history.
I know. I can't imagine. I read up on the case all the time. There's a book by Steve Oney called And the Dead Shall Rise. And it gets so frustrating. And so when I listen to the musical too, over the last 15 years, I listen to it and it just gets so frustrating to listen and know that he's basically being framed. He is being framed. And it's so hard to listen to it. It's upsetting.
One thing that really surprised me when I started learning more about this is how I didn't know about this case. It's mm-hmm. not that I didn't even know about the musical. I didn't know about this case in 1913. And right. I mean, like, that was 100 years ago, and there are other things that have happened since, but it's still, like, mm-hmm. this seems like it was a really horrible thing that happened that I just did not learn about in history class, never heard about in pop culture.
No. I never learned about it in school. And he's the only Jewish man in America to ever be lynched. Like, that's a big thing to be talked about.
Yeah. And it's the most morbid title I've ever heard.
I know. And actually, the original title was I Love a Parade.
Oh, no.
Thank God they changed it.
Yeah. I mean, it's still, like, it's interesting that they chose to call it Parade, because that's, you know, I think that everybody has very positive associations with parades, and they're supposed to be celebrations, and it's like, tricked ya.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, I understand because, you know, it all kind of started with a Confederate parade. But yeah, I mean, they can't call it like lynching the musical. Like,
oh,
they can't call it Leo Frank the musical. You know, it's so I understand why it's called Parade.
Mm-hmm. It's very Sondheim-esque, I think, almost in a lot of ways. I think clearly that with him being sort of the front runner to write it, I didn't read about like why he declined or anything. He just mm-hmm. didn't want to do it, or he was busy or whatever. Right. But I feel like a lot of the subject matter, the sort of the titling choice of some of, and the way that it's handled is mm-hmm. clearly like very inspired by the Sondheim method.
Oh, absolutely. And it's so hard. I mean, I'm not Stephen Sondheim, but I would also turn it down because I wouldn't know how to write a musical about this subject matter without not even just offending someone, but offending the case. And, you know, because how do you do it without making every single thing a ballad?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And yet somehow Jason Robert Brown wrote a bunch of bops.
That should be illegal, but he did it.
Right.
Yeah.
I listen to come up to my office and I'm like, oh, this is so creepy, but why is it so catchy?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the beauties of musical theater is that it does so often take these incredibly dark stories, even in our own history, true stories, and turns them into something that is digestible and understandable and catchy.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Fun Home, the Oof. Raincoat of Love, and the Welcome to the funeral home song, and I'm like, oh, this bops, but oh man, this is so depressing.
So much stuff in the music to talk about with this show. Do you want to just start and sort of dive into the music, and then we can circle back around more towards it in context later?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it is the greatest score in musical theater history.
Interesting.
I think it's so complex, and especially if you just listen to the piano work, like in This Is Not Over Yet, you're like, holy, like, it's so complex. And I think he was so clever with, you know, the innocence of the songs for Mary Fagan, and then the kind of like a little bit of a Southern sort of, motif for the people in Atlanta, or even for a little bit of Lucille, and then just the depressingness of Leo Frank, and mm-hmm. then the menacing kind of music for like Jim Conley and for all the racists.
Yeah, there's so much that this music says, even if you took out the lyrics, and it still paints a picture like of the arc of the story.
Like when you listen to the Act One finale, like when he is being sentenced, it's so menacing.
Yes. I love even at the very beginning of this musical I feel like sets the stage. I guess that's a pun, but it does set the stage in such one of the most breathtaking ways that I think I've seen in a musical, where it starts with this Confederate soldier going off to war, and then transforms into that soldier as an old man and a veteran at a parade. Like decades later. And that I think just hammers home the message without ever saying it explicitly, but it sets this beginning of the stage of like, this is a deep South town, like Confederate town, and all of the culture that comes with that. And that is where our story is going to be.
Yep. And they can't move on.
they're a little bit invested.
Yeah. They're always telling black people to get over slavery, but they can't get over losing a goddamn war. But no, because I introduced a friend to the musical the other day, and she was like, what's the deal with the soldier? I was like, it's a framing device.
Sorry, just you said that so emphatically.
I was very passionate about it. But it is to set it up about how kind of racist and stuck on the Civil War the South is. And then
you like immediately have this character dropped in who's Jewish, mm-hmm. who's a Yankee. Mm-hmm. I really like, I don't know why he's there. Why is he there?
Yeah. So historically, I mean, Lucille's uncle or somebody also worked in the pencil factory and had a job for Leo. So they all moved. So she and Leo moved down to Atlanta from New York, so that he could work at the pencil factory.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
So that's why he's down there, and he never felt welcome.
Yeah. Well, yeah. He was right.
Yeah. Oh, that's morbid.
That's really dark. I'm sorry.
Nah, it's so dark. But, like, and so, you know, immediately in the musical, because, and also it's how it is, was historically, he wasn't a likable person. Mm-hmm. To these people, because he didn't feel like he belonged there, and he's from New York, and maybe we're not likable people, I don't know, but because he wasn't used to the South, where everything's kind of like people are fake nice and they don't have any or maybe they have too many manners, but they don't have any manners towards other people that aren't from the South and all that. Mm-hmm. So there it was a troubling kind of start for him.
Yeah, this was he was not like the most popular person in town before this happened.
No. And I mean, a lot of that does have to do with his Jewishness.
Absolutely. And this musical was written by like Alfred Urey and Jason Robert Brown are both Jewish, mm-hmm. and like writing very much from that experience. And I think like we already talked about like Alfred Urey's personal family connection to it, as well as I think both of them felt very much like a cultural connection to the story and it being important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that they have such the personal connection to the Jewishness. And obviously Parade, it is very hard to ignore the Jewishness. Like you can't. That is a main plot point, and I feel like people kind of ignore that part of falsettos. Like they ignore the Jewishness, they're like, oh, it's gay, but everybody ignores the Jewishness. Mm-hmm. But Parade, you can't, you like physically cannot.
that is the factor on which everything sort of revolves around, and which is of course just horrible, just horrifying to think about for any amount of time. Especially, I think that where just like on the historical side of the true story, which this, as far as I know, and like my own readings of it, like is considered widely very accurate to what happened. Mm-hmm. And like the fact that this happened in 1913, like at the very beginning of the 20th century and like pre-World War II, and sort of like this, I think was a very precarious time for Jewish people, that mm-hmm. no one really talks about, like it being a problem in the United States, even though it absolutely was.
Yeah. I read it in the book that I always read, or I maybe heard somebody talk about it. And I think that it was a lot of it was overshadowed by the fact that the Titanic had just sunk.
Oh, interesting. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this was kind of swept under and ignored.
I did not think about those things happening like at the same time, but I guess, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was maybe a couple months, like a difference, but same year.
But I think especially in terms of like what makes the history books, as opposed to like what the news of the day was, that Titanic mm-hmm. is something that like everyone knows about and is the subject of like one of the most popular movies of all time and all this thing in it. And it kind of casts this long shadow around everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, also to speak on the anti-Semitism, people really do not care about that, mm-hmm. you know?
I'm sure that, well, one of the aspects of this case and that is highlighted in the musical was how it was covered in the news.
Absolutely. Yes. He was villainized.
And it was sensationalized. And it was one of those early examples of like clickbait journalism, basically.
Oh, absolutely.
Going back to like score full of bangers. I think the song Big News both encapsulates that idea really well of what was going on.
The need for it.
Yeah. Yeah,
the need for a big story. And that song was actually cut. It was only on the album.
Was it? I did not realize that.
Yeah, it was cut out of the show. I think probably during previews, I was talking to Evan Pappas, the original Britt Craig, and he said that he is the only person to ever have that song recorded. So, and he doesn't want it back in the musical because he thinks that that's very special.
Okay, that's
but cute. I like it in there because I do think you're right. It does express the media's need for a big story.
Mm-hmm. And then I think that's like sort of exists throughout the musical and in other songs and in Real Big News and everything. But I think that having a song just completely dedicated to, hey, look at this fun, exciting story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and the way that the music is so chipper and exciting, and it's very like, look, suddenly we're in Newsies, despite the subject matter. I think that really that contrast works so well for this musical. It's a scandal of the age. Hell, it's big news, another shock.
Yeah, and I think I think Jason or Alfred, they had talked about how the reason why they cut it was because Britt Craig's like drunkenness of him, because basically the setting of the song is that he's like, Britt Craig is this young journalist, he's like drunken in a bar and he's like slurring and talking about how he needs a big story and all this stuff. And I think that Alfred and Hal and Jason had decided to cut it because they thought that it spent too much time like kind of giving like a little bit of a backstory on Britt Craig. They felt like they kind of spent a little bit too much time on him. But I think that they were smart to have backstory on him because he was a very big part of what happened to Leo, because he added to the outcry and the fear mongering
mm-hmm.
of the case.
Yeah, just as it is continued up to and ever increasing every day, it's like the way that the media covers something will significantly impact what happens, unfortunately, even in cases like the legal system.
Exactly. Yeah, there's no way. I was just thinking, because I was called for jury duty a couple weeks ago, and I'm like thinking that there's like no way that you will not read about a case that you may end up on the jury for, because so many things are covered and so many things you will, there will end up always being a bias.
That's like, because in tons of cases are small enough that you never know. But I always wonder how they get jurors for really high profile cases. Like, you could read, like, they were trying to get jurors for the Martin Tricelli case, but every person they asked was like, no, I hate him, I can't be impartial.
Oh,
it's like, who doesn't know about this case?
Right. Like, about, or with the kids who killed that kid in the Bronx. Like, everybody read about that. You can't not have read about it.
Sometimes I truly am amazed with just, like, I say ignorance, but I mean that not negatively, but, like, the true meaning of the word, just, like, the ignorance of people who don't read the news and truly don't know what's going on. And I'm like, aren't you on Twitter?
Yeah. And so then, you know, all the things that happened with Leo Frank's case, he was in this very small, I mean, he was in Atlanta, Georgia, but the trial happened in Atlanta, not Marietta. The girl was from Marietta and all the people were from Marietta. But there's, and think of just how much, you know, how much smaller the population was, you know, back in 1913. There's no way that these people on the jury did not read every single thing that happened and, you know, about this case. So
yeah.
It was absolutely just a vendetta against him. And the musical touches on that. He was villainized from the very beginning.
And we've talked briefly about the case in particular, but I was wondering if you could give me sort of a brief rundown in more detail of, like, what happened with the case in the trial, so we can talk about that more.
So basically, Mary Fagan was a 13, 14-year-old girl who worked in a pencil factory that Leo Frank was the superintendent of, and he was the last person to see her alive when she went to him to go grab her paycheck. And he was home when the police came to his door to tell him that a girl had been found dead and raped in the basement of the pencil factory. And because he was the last one to see her alive, they suspected him. And it also kind of happened that the governor was on the prosecutor's ass to get a conviction, because for the specific case, but also just in general, because I guess a lot of conviction, like, the prosecutor had a very low conviction rate. So the prosecutor he made it a mission to make sure that he has someone guilty, and I don't think he really cared who it was. And, you know, with anti-Semitism, he kind of was ready to convict this guy, whether or not he was guilty. And so that kind of added into the way that the police kind of questioned Leo to kind of trick him into questions that they could use against him. So I think it happened over about 2 years, the trial. So the prosecutor, he very much manipulated all witnesses, or quote unquote witnesses. So Jim Conley, the janitor, who people believe that he did it himself, that he was the actual, perpetrator, he had escaped. He was an escaped convict, and I think the prosecutor came to him to kind of, like, threaten him, being like, hey, if you don't say this about Leo Frank, I'm going to put you back in jail. And it was very messed up. He was, and the prosecutor also kind of groomed these girls who worked in the pencil factory for them to be like, hey, Leo Frank was creepy towards me. Everything was very much orchestrated by the state of Georgia and by the prosecutor. And the case happened over, like, a period of 2 years, and he got a guilty verdict. He was sentenced to death, and Lucille, his wife, did everything that she could and went to the governor and, like, begged him to look at the evidence, begged the state to look at the evidence, to reevaluate the case. And I think the governor probably felt a little guilty. I forget if that this is incredibly true in the history, but this is how it is in the musical, that the governor kind of felt very guilty and reevaluated the case and looked at it, and he commuted this is very true in the history. So he commuted Leo's death sentence to a life sentence, and the people of Atlanta were very, very upset about that. So Leo was transferred to another prison, and when he was transferred to that other prison, members of the KKK and you know, former soldiers and people of Marietta, people who were friends with the deceased, they broke into Leo's cell and kidnapped him, and they lynched him from a tree.
And then someone wrote a musical about it.
Exactly. I know. When I tell people about people who have never heard of Parade, I tell them about the story of what happened, and then I'll be like, and then they wrote a musical about it, and everybody's like, you okay?
Uh-huh. And he was 31 when he was murdered. So he was quite young when this started.
Yeah, he was very, very young. And Lucille was pretty young. But in the context of the show, I mean, Carolee Carmello and Brent Carver were about like late 30s, like 35, 36 when they did the role. And they do have – and you know what's so funny when I look back on shows, like older shows – and you see these people that you love now, like that are kind of older now, and how young they were then. And you're like, oh, they look the same. They don't look that young. And I can't tell if it's because they're so familiar to you that you're like, oh, they look a little, they still look a bit older, or everybody just looks younger now. Because like when Betsy Wolf was first cast in Falsettos, I was like, she's too young. She's too young. And she was the exact same age that Carolee Carmello was when she played Cordelia. But I think just because Carolee is so familiar now in her older sense that she just seems like she was older back then.
It's also like as we get older, we think that everyone's younger because they're like closer to our age. And we're like, wait, no.
Exactly. But yeah, so they were – so the Franks were pretty young when everything happened. But in the context of the musical, they are kind of – maybe like I like them to be perceived as like late 30s. And I know that Michael Arden held a reading recently with very, very young actors, Ben Platt and Michaela Diamond.
Yeah, I saw that.
And listen, I love Michaela Diamond and I love Ben Platt. Michaela Diamond will make an amazing Lucille in 10 years. Same with Ben. I, for me personally, do not like seeing such young people playing these roles because the songs, All the Wasted Time, like that song is about these people having, you know, having no time left in their marriage after all these years together and finally kind of rekindling their love for each other. And that's not going to have the same impact with two 20-year-olds singing it.
Yeah, that's kind of the thought I had because I was like looking at the Wikipedia page of productions and I was like, oh, like Jeremy Jordan did this. And then I saw Ben Platt. And I was like, Ben Platt did this last year? What's happening?
And even Jeremy Jordan's too young to me. Yeah. I mean, he did a wonderful job, but I like to see, I mean, my dream cast is Carmen Cusack and Jake Gyllenhaal or Brandon Urenowitz. And because you want that impact of why the painfulness, like I think, because All the Wasted Time is my favorite song. And I just think it's, there won't be the impact of these people have their, you know, doomed marriage.
Because it's like, there's the question of their literal ages in the historical sense, but there's also sort of that sense of like representing that time. For one, people didn't live as long in the 1910s, which is a little morbid just to say, but it is true.
I know.
So like relatively speaking, that is a factor, as well. Absolutely. As sort of like the resonance of their relationship and their place in history, I think you're right, is better represented with like a little bit of an age bump.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I people on Broadway World are always like dream casting revivals of Parade, and you know, when the whole Ben Platt and Michaela Diamond thing came out, they were like, oh, they're perfect ages for it. And then everybody's like, no, they're too young. And then someone's like, yeah, but the actual age. And it's like, but there's the ages of them and then the ages of the musical. So it's just, yeah, I don't like seeing college students do it.
even though they're exact ages, they were still like 29 at the beginning of this, which is older than 24 or however old Ben Platt is, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He's way too young. If he could play a 16-year-old last year, he can't play a 29-year-old this year.
I like to imagine you decreeing that, like, at a judge's stand.
It is law. I love him to death. He'll make a great Leo in 10 years.
Yeah. Maybe they'll be ready for a parade revival in 10 years.
Oh, God, I can only hope. But then Carmen Cusack will be too old for it, and then I can't have that. I need her to play Lucille.
Oh, no.
I have my list of people who I need to play the role, or who are allowed to play the role.
There's still hope. There's still time.
Yeah. I feel like the gatekeeper of parade. People come to me and they're like, what do you think about this person? And I'm like, and I don't know how to tell them that they're wrong and they should not be playing the role. And I'm like, I feel mean when people are like, hey, can my favorite person play that? I'm like, oh, they can play Mrs. Fagan.
You're like, as the casting director for all productions of Parade, I regret to inform you.
Literally. I'm not even kidding. I literally have like a note in my phone that's like, I want this theater. I want this person to do the set design. I want this person to do the sound design. I want $35 for Rush. I want a lottery that's $19.13 to reflect the time period that it was.
Oh my God.
It's very detailed.
You just need to become a Broadway producer tomorrow.
Listen, that is my actual literal dream. I work in TV now, but I love TV. But if I do make my way into the theater world, my dream is to put on a production of Parade and make it happen.
Oh my God, absolutely.
Because I know, Jake Gyllenhaal, he is the perfect Leo, and he's profitable.
God damn it. You've thought this out.
Listen, I saw him. I hadn't seen him in Little Shop, but then I went and saw the Sunday in the Park with George concert at City Center, and I saw it and I said, "Holy shit!" Because there are many movie actors who can sing, but there are not many movie actors who can sing Stephen Sondheim. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, "Oh man, this man is incredible!" And I immediately wrote him down as my dream Leo. And I mean, there's plenty of men that I would also love to do the role, but he is a celebrity and Broadway needs celebrities. I don't like that, but they do.
As long as we're working within these parameters, I can do this.
Exactly. I need, because I will not sacrifice Carmen Cusack out of this damn role. I need a celebrity opposite her. Unless Lincoln Center wants to do it again as a production that doesn't need that goddamn money.
So we've cast the next Broadway production, so that's a check off the to-do list. One thing that I wanted to circle back to on the side of the subject matter being extremely depressing and horrifying on all levels, just the aspect that you talked about in the trial of, like, I feel like there are many cases where, like, something has gone wrong and, like, someone was wrongfully convicted and there were like racial influences into why that decision was made. But I think what makes this case so especially heartbreaking was that, like, this was such a clear conspiracy. Like, this was not an implicit influence. This was like someone went out and planted witnesses. Like, they went out and planted evidence and cajoled people into giving false testimony, and just a whole host of morally despicable and literally illegal things in order to convict someone who did not commit a crime.
I know. And it's heartbreaking because people were so dead set on believing the corruption. Like, they were believing those very corrupt people because of the racial influences of, you know, and the fact that, but I think that also they would have, had Jim Conley been on the stand, they also, because they use the N-word in the musical, and that is the one thing that if they ever do, I understand because it was the racist South, but they do very much take too many liberties in the usage of the N-word in the musical. But if Jim Conley had been on trial, who people do believe is the actual killer himself, that I think that it kind of almost would have been the same result, because people in the South hate black people, and then people in the South also hate Jewish people. So it's, there was no way for a fair trial for either of those people.
I feel like if this had been a fictional story that was written, it would have been like Leo Frank was the victim of rampant anti-Semitism that's happened to him, but like the real perpetrator would have been the rich white governor's son, you know, like sort of,
exactly.
Sort of like that like perfect criminal. Whereas in this case, like, no, it was like a poor black man who, as best we understand and like historians understand it, the actual perpetrator was a poor black man who was an escaped convict. And like, and so yes, absolutely. Racism would have played a huge part in his life and like would have played a part in his trial, but he also did commit the crime. So
exactly. It's so hard. It's so hard. And the thing is that, oh God, especially like in this era right now, not in terms of race or anything, but because, so I think it was like maybe around the time of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, Carolee reposted a video of her singing You Don't Know This Man. And that song is all about her trying to prove her husband's innocence. And I was like, and in my head, I'm like, oh no, this is not the best time to be doing that. Because it's very hard too, because with Parade, it's like, yes, you should always believe victims, but there was these girls that, you know, quote unquote, came forward, were very much groomed to lie. But it's so hard because it's like, you have to believe people, but it's all, you know, it's just everything was orchestrated against him. But then people are so, there's such a hive mind. Like once somebody lies about some case, then no case can ever be real. Like, you know, with the Jesse Smollett case, people are like, oh, now that he's lied, no racist and homophobic attacks can ever be real again. And that's, like, what's so hard about Parade is, like, these girls lied. And so it's so hard to kind of reconcile that these girls lied. And this is one case. This is one case where someone was framed, and that's the problem with kind of the society is that they see that he was framed, so then they're going to think that everyone has been framed.
And I think that's something that this shows is like it is so complicated, and we see with horrifying frequency just things going wrong in our justice system, and it's absolutely. Cases when sexual assault survivors are not believed in their perpetrators are not punished, but as well as like when people are falsely accused, and in the most famous cases, we do see this most often against black men. And then in this case, a Jewish man, and like, like that's not a coincidence.
No, not at all.
All the different aspects of society influence each other and they intersect, and like that's why we take each case individually, and it's supposedly like every case is given a fair and measured chance for justice, but then when like the racism and the anti-Semitism or like in the sexism in different cases influences
they
that,
mix
yeah they're like that's intersectional oppression right there.
100%. And that's why I love this musical so much, because it makes people think. And I think that's part of the downfall of the musical itself for why it closed, because people walked out of the musical being really depressed, which, hello, I walk out of Dear Evan Hansen depressed and I still love it. So, but people walked out of Parade being very upset, you know, being depressed because there was no happy ending. And also, I think people were very much slapped in the face with their own racism and their own anti-Semitism. And I think people could not deal with that, especially in 1998. Like, you know, because maybe more so now people are kind of confronting their own racism and their own anti-Semitism. People kind of realize, you know, because it is way more, people are, I mean, I hate to say the word woke, but people are a little bit more woke now. But people were very afraid of it. People are always afraid of their own racism. People don't like to admit it. And I think that was a lot of the issue with the musical and audiences when it was originally on. Mm-hmm. People didn't like to hear the facts and see, like, what they were doing wrong or what their ancestors were doing wrong. And that was a lot of the downfall.
Yeah, the show ran for only a few months before mm-hmm. before it closed. And
135 performances, I think, I believe, total.
Not that many.
Nope.
Yeah, and so, which is interesting, because I feel like it it's picked up a very sort of, I won't say cult favorite, but I feel like for theater nerds, it's a cult favorite.
Yes, it has lived on. It has lived on mm-hmm. with lots of new fans.
Yeah, it's sort of like once you start getting into musicals and then you start getting into like the more weird stuff, I think this is one of the first ones that you encounter as like, here's a musical that wasn't given its due.
For sure. And it's also produced in a lot of high schools. So I think that is also a lot of people that I see, like, you know, that I follow on Twitter or whatever. If they like tell me that they love Parade, it's because they did it in high school.
Oh.
So I think that's a lot of it too.
I'm always surprised to hear about what shows are getting done in high school. So I didn't realize this was like one of those.
I know, it's really messed up.
Yeah.
To do this in high school.
Why doesn't high schools ever do just like The Wizard of Oz anymore? I feel like everybody's doing really intense things.
Yeah. I know. You know what? Because we're all depressed.
Yeah.
But yeah. So it just sucks so much that it didn't run for so long, because that is the that is the reason why it did not win Best Musical. And I will always be bitter about that, because I love Fosse. I love Bob Fosse, and I love Fosse the musical, but it is a review. Mm-hmm. It's a review. It is not a book musical. And the fact that Parade won Best Book, Best Score, but did not win Best Musical, that upsets me, as you can tell.
I can tell.
I will always have a vendetta against the Tony Awards for that.
Don't we all have that year that was like, how dare you for the Tony Awards?
Oh, 100%. I have very specific things over the years about that. And also, it's so hard because I love Bernadette Peters with my entire heart. But Carolee Carmello should have won.
And it's so interesting as well that it wins Best Book and Score and nothing else. Like, you do not see that very often.
Well, Falsettos did that too, and that hurts.
Oh, yeah.
But I do love Crazy for You. But
I guess they were like, we really like the material of this and we don't like any aspect of the production.
That hurts. That hurts.
I mean, they were nominated 9 times, so that's nothing to shake a stick at. But yeah, they only ended up winning 2.
And I do like, I mean, I think that is amazing because it had closed in February already.
Yeah.
And that is a very unheard of thing for a show to get that many nominations. But also it was a very weak year, as you can see by a literal ballet. but, you know, I just wish that it had still been open, because I think that things would have been different.
This is another, there are so many shows that we visited for this podcast where it's like they closed with varying levels of success a certain number of years ago. Mm-hmm. And then you look back at it and you're like, I feel like the time for this musical is actually now.
Yes. The time for this is now.
Oh. Are you listening, Jake Gyllenhaal?
Yes. I'm not even kidding. He made an Instagram and the first thing that I did was slide into his DMs and say, sir, would you like to play Leo Frank? He did not answer, and I'm very upset at him. But if I do go see Seawall or A Life or whatever that play that is that he's doing down at the Public, and I go meet him, I will convince him to play Leo Frank.
That's incredible.
I had a dream a couple months ago, actually, that I ran into Jake Gyllenhaal, and I was like, hi, sir, do you want to play Leo Frank in Parade? And he was like, yeah, let's do it. Let's find ourselves he was like, let's do it. And I was like, well, I'm not a producer. And he was like, well, let's find ourselves producers. And I was like, okay, but we can't do it this season. We have to do it next season because Tony Yazbek needs to win his Tony for Crazy for You. And now Crazy for You is not even happening. So right now, but I literally in my subconscious was like, okay, but Tony Yazbek needs to win a Tony over you. So let's do it next year.
I'm suddenly very glad that I've given you the chance to talk about Parade on a podcast, because I feel like this consumes a lot of your time when you're dreaming about it.
It really, really, truly does. My life has been this for the last, oh God, what year is it? It is 2019. 15 years. The last 15 years of my life has been this. Like, I literally, my friend got me a hat made that says Revive Parade.
Wow.
Jason Robert Brown, literally, I'm not even kidding. He like stalks my tweets sometimes because he like will find my tweets that don't mention him but mention Parade. But you can't search the word Parade because everybody says the word Parade on Twitter and he does not follow me. So there's no way for him to find these tweets unless he stalks them himself. And it was funny because when I met him the first time, he was like, oh, I know who you are.
Oh my God. Wait, my new life goal is to become so well known for loving a musical that the creator recognizes me.
Right? No, so I actually, because he had tweeted, someone had asked him being like, oh, the Lincoln Center concert was such a tease. We need a full scale revival. And Jason had tweeted back at that person and was like, well, I'm hoping there's something that might be happening. And I literally like freaked out, printed that tweet out, framed it and put it on my wall. And because I was like, you know, it was kind of like in a vision board kind of way where I wanted this revival to happen. Mm-hmm. And then months, or maybe like a year later, or recently, I don't remember, but I had quoted that tweet from Jason Robert Brown, and I was like, hey, remember that time I literally framed this tweet? And he tweeted back at me and was like, literally, Pixar, it didn't happen. And I sent him the picture, and he said, oh, you fucking framed it? You are not fucking around, Laura Brown.
He's going to get a restraining order against you.
He does not realize how much this musical means to me, but it's fine. No, I think he loves it. I think, you know, because I feel like that's what sucks about Jason Robert Brown is that he's so genius. And I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of the last 5 years, but The Bridges of Madison County and 13 and Parade, like he... I love his musicals, and none of them ever last, but they do have a lot of, not a cult following, but they have a lot of fandom, and I just wish that he had more commercial success.
Yeah. I mean, there's
his musicals.
There's still time. Like,
there's still time.
He's got a big catalog out there. If someone wants to start reviving his stuff and putting more back on Broadway, there's a lot to choose from.
Parade. Or even Bridges. Listen, I know it's been like 5 years, but we can do it. Let's make it happen.
It's been 5 years since it went off and you're like, let's revive it.
Yeah. And I love that we have been given lots of tastes of sort of revivals or concerts or whatever over the years of Parade, because it has been very special. I didn't see the show live until about 2009 when it was in LA. With the Donmar Warehouse production that T.R. Knight and Laura Pulver were part of. I literally flew out to L.A. just to see that because, you know, it was a production that I could go see. Mm-hmm. And it was so special to me. Like, no, of course, nothing will ever, for me, you know, beat the original. And, I mean, yes, revivals are amazing, all that stuff. Regional productions are amazing. But it was just, it was so special to be able to see a production of Parade. They did make a lot of changes. Songs were cut, songs were added. It was double cast. I was not a fan of that, but I understand because I think that's that's a lot of the reasoning behind Parade not being revived. And same thing with Ragtime is that it's such a large cast.
Yeah, and this was the thing that I was thinking about with the success that Joe Iconis has had recently, in that mm-hmm. he's never had shows go to Broadway before, and now he's having, like, Be More Chill hasn't even opened yet. It's extremely successful. And then they just announced that a new one of his shows is coming to Broadway next year. And then...
Wait, really? Which one?
Broadway Bounty Hunter.
Oh
yeah, that's breaking news as of yesterday, I think.
Oh God, I've been in such work mode that I haven't even seen that. Oh my God, good for him.
Yeah, I know. And Jason Robert Brown is different in that he's had more quote unquote mainstream success and has had more shows on Broadway than Joe Iconis. But it's also just a thing of like a person who has worked for a long time more on the edges and hasn't really broken through into like, it has a large catalog, but hasn't really come into like super mainstream success in the theater world. Mm-hmm. And I think about that and it's like, that really can happen at any time, is that just like the right production happens and then finally you break through and then finally all of your work gets the chance to be seen on a bigger stage.
Right. Oh, I would love that for him. You know, not to, you know, root for more old white men in the theater, but
yeah, there's that.
But I just think he's so genius. Like, God, if you just listen to the piano work and this is not over yet, you're like, holy sh! It's so complex.
One more aspect of the music that I wanted to talk about is, we haven't really touched on at all, is just like the theme of Leo and Lucille's relationship throughout the musical and how it starts very explicitly as like, it, before anything happens, like they're feeling distant from each other and Lucille's feeling like he's working all the time and it's showing strain on their marriage, and sort of this really beautiful and yet and obviously heartbreaking plotline of like throughout the horrible strife of, and that's just throughout the strife of the accusations and the trial, them coming together as a couple and rediscovering that love, which is taken away from them at the end, but still getting to have that full arc, and the really beautiful song that it ends with of all the wasted time.
All the million hours pushing you away, building up my wall.
It's so heartbreaking because I don't know if you had the chance to like read the script or anything, but because obviously not a lot of it is captured on the cast recording, but in the beginning of the play, it is kind of very a little bit obvious that they were, like, they fell in love very, very young. She wants him to be less Jewish. He wants her to be less Southern. She's Jewish as well. But, you know, in the song, he literally says she would rather I say howdy, not shalom. And there's very much a disconnect between both of them. And also they talk about like reproducing, and it kind of does seem like they are, sometimes that might be the only reason why they're married is to reproduce, or maybe they are struggling with reproducing. So that has put a strain on their marriage, and then them having to move, like, and, you know, everything puts a stress on a marriage. And then, being accused for rape and murder when you didn't do it really does put a stress on a lot of people. So, you know, he rightfully is snapping at her, and, you know, the song Do It Alone, where she, you know, where she rips into him and is like, okay, then do it by your freaking self. there's a lot of strain on the marriage. And then, I do love that they come together in All the Wasted Time. And it's just so, God, it's one of the most heartbreaking scenes. Like, nothing will ever be as special to me when they are in his cell sitting on the floor. And God, I think this is the most beautiful, beautiful part of the show. So in the beginning of the show, Lucille asks him to go on a picnic with her, and he's like, no, I have to work. And that is the reason. And while he is at work, that is when Mary Fagan comes to him to ask for her paycheck. So it's like, oh, if he had gone on that picnic, you know, this wouldn't be happening, maybe. But so she asks him to go on a picnic with her, and he doesn't. He goes to work. And all of this spirals and everything. And then in the big 11 o'clock number, All the Wasted Time, they're sitting in his cell and she's putting on a picnic for him. And they finally get to have that picnic. They get to have that picnic that she always wanted. And she's so hopeful. I love that about Lucille. And she was like this in history, but I think that it's more so also in the musical. It is kind of, not an exaggeration, but they kind of improve on her character, that she is just, she is a very tough lady who comes off as a little bit dainty to these people, and but she is hopeful. She isn't pessimistic. She has so much hope. She has so much faith in the good of people. And I love that about her. She is my favorite musical theater character in history. And, you know, she says to Leo, she's like, you know, she brings their wedding china to the picnic in his cell. Like, I think that's so beautiful. And she's like, oh, you know, you have a little bit of a tan. And he gets this tan from when he's working out in the yard in prison. And he's like, I'm a farm boy now. And she's like, well, it is very becoming. And then she's like, and you can plant us a vegetable garden when you get home. You are coming home, Leo. She is very adamant about having faith in the system and the people and their love for each other. She does not give up on their love and on him. And I just think that's so beautiful. And then we all know what happens next.
Yeah. And just to have that hope in the face of really nothing that has happened so far to base it on, but to still have that and to still like cherish that time that you have with your spouse. And then I think that's probably like, and that song, that's almost the last song of the whole show. And I think that is why people in particular, I think that just made this show like even more depressing is the way that it's set up, and that like you, if it ended there, it almost presents this like idea of like, you know, this is really sad and horrible, but like they're still together, and like there's hope that he will be retried and justice will be set one day. But that's not what happened. And so it ends like with what actually happened. And then you walk out of the theater and you're like, well, nothing matters.
You're depressed. I know. But, and then, yeah, everybody is just so upset about it. But I do love that, you know, the finale is Lucille saying that, you know, he's not in pain anymore. And she like, oh God, I love her so much. She always believes that everything is going like, you know, of course, oh God, of course she's upset and depressed that he's gone, but she is so optimistic. And I love that. And oh God, it's so painful. So, obviously they don't show this on the cast recording, and they did, this happened in the actual historical, case or, you know, events, when the KKK was, lynching him before he did, he said, wait. And they're like, what now? And he said, I want my wedding ring to go to my wife. And he gave it to one of the KKK members, one of the lynching mob. And I don't remember which member it was, but he got it to Britt Craig. He brought it to the journalist or the real, it wasn't, I don't think that was his real name in history, but in the musical, that's what his name is. And he brought it to him. And that's the last scene right before the finale, song. Is Britt Craig expressing his condolences to Lucille and bringing the wedding ring that Leo was wearing. And I just, it's so heartbreaking.
You know, I want to cry even just thinking about that.
I know. It's so tough. God, it's so hard to say the word beautiful about the musical, but it is. It's beautiful.
I think that's why this story was told, is because it is so devastating, and yet these aspects of absolute love and poetry like existed in the true story, and just lend itself to the music and to the creation of this narrative.
Yeah.
And of all the musicals that are based on real historical events, like I mentioned before, like I did some reading about this, and I also like you can read the historians that have like looked at the musical pretty much agree that this is a goddamn faithful adaptation of what happened.
Yes.
Which is wild.
Yeah. Like, they did put an exaggeration on the marriage between Leo and Lucille, mm-hmm. made that more of the forefront of the musical. But I think that's necessary. Because I don't think that you can have a very much bio-type musical of a very depressing historical event without having some sort of hope. And the love story is the hope. Mm-hmm. And that's the tagline of the musical was a true story, a love story. A musical. And I think that that's beautiful because that is what it is.
And like you were saying before, when the audience walks out, they kind of have to confront their own ideas throughout the show. And it's like, you can't, even though it's ultimately the emotional core of this is centered around the love story, it is impossible mm-hmm. to ignore or get away from grappling from the race politics and the anti-Semitism in the show and like how different characters interact with that. And it's like, that's something that you have to deal with and stares you in the face the entire time.
Exactly. And people can't do that. But I like that. I like musicals that make you think.
Mm-hmm. I think the last piece that I wanted to say about the historical aspects of this is I was reading about the case and it was like this the whole case around Leo Frank is credited for helping the rise of two different groups. And one of them was like the KKK in Atlanta and the other one was the Anti-Defamation League. And I'm like, wow, that is... Like that says, I feel like that is like a microcosm of the entirety of history. It's like this horrible thing happened and from it came increased bigotry and like the force that fights that bigotry.
I know. And I think, oh God, that's so beautiful. And that's why it's like baffling that this case is never talked about.
Yeah.
Because that is so big.
But I feel like this had huge effects that we just never acknowledged.
I know. And that's why I love that. I mean, not only the fact that the musical is so beautiful and the score is gorgeous, but I love that they did a musical on this because it did bring this case to the fore. I didn't know about the case. I just fell in love with the score when I fell in love with Carol Lee. And then I read up on the case and I've been reading like books on it for the last 15 years. And I love it. And I like that it's brought so much more attention to it.
Yeah.
So I think these things are very important to do when, you know, cases like these need to be made musical, you know, mm-hmm. make a musical of it.
Absolutely. I think we are getting to about time. So are you ready to move on to the lightning round?
Yeah. Oh, God. I have a Libra moon. I'm very indecisive.
You can pick a couple things if you are okay. Really, really going between them. But let's start with, what is your favorite song on the score?
All the Wasted Time. I know it's like the most popular song and everyone's like, oh, so cliche, but it is. There's nothing more beautiful to me than that one.
Absolutely. And what is your favorite line in the show?
My favorite line is when Lucille, like I said before, is when she says, "You can plant us a vegetable garden when you get home, Leo. You are coming home."
Oh,
I know. She's so hopeful.
It's so sad.
She's so hopeful, and I love that.
Well, I think we also have covered this, but your favorite character?
Is it Lucille Frank? I don't know. I don't think we talked about that.
Is she your favorite character in all of musical theater? I don't know.
Maybe so.
Is she also the character that you would want to play?
If I performed? Yes. But I also don't feel like I'd be able to do her justice, so I'd rather see other people do her.
That's such a humble answer to this question.
I know. I feel like if I were to choose to be in the show while having my dream Lucille play the role, like having Carmen, I would probably want to be Mrs. Fagan.
Mm-hmm.
Or Sally Slayton. No, Sally Slayton. That's my answer.
Oh, okay. All right, I guess that. Who would you recommend go see this show?
Everybody. Everybody needs it for something. Not to quote Dear Evan Hansen, but everybody needs it for something. You know, everybody's got to confront their racism and their anti-Semitism, and everybody needs hope and love and, healing and reasons to be mad about the state of the world and, you know, things that kind of make us want justice and want fairness and all that.
All right.
Everybody needs to see it.
And finally, if you could combine the show with another one, which one would you pick?
Ragtime. Those are the two that, like, I'm always like, we need a revival of Parade and we need a revival of Ragtime. And if we can do them in rep, let's do it.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see, like, there are so many thematic similarities. I feel like the music has similarities that there could be a real collaboration there.
Yeah. Lots, very, very even more depressing than it already is.
Yeah, you know, just really amp that up.
Just amp up all the crying.
If you'd like to listen to our episode on Ragtime, that will be linked in the show notes.
Yes.
Got a self-promo right here at the end.
Got you. The only thing that would suck about having to put Parade and Ragtime together is that I want Carmen Cusack to play Mother as well, so she can't do both.
I mean, couldn't she?
She could. She is that talented.
I think that brings us to the end. So thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me and letting me spew all my passionate crap about Parade.
Absolutely. And thank you all for listening. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Corner of the Sky. You can find us online at theincomparable.com/COTS or follow us on Twitter at COTS Podcast. If you like, you could also review us on Apple Podcasts or star us in Overcast. See you next week.